Obviously, the stability of the US government is super important to startups everywhere, to human beings everywhere. We all need a good, happy, healthy US government. People on that front are mostly focused right now, I think, on the US election. Will Biden win? Will Trump win? I don't see a lot of people talking about what happens post-election. I think there's a meaningful chance, actually, of significant instability and even violence, irrespective of who wins.
You're listening to the Startup Podcast. This is a Reacts episode. Industry insiders having frank debates about the latest tech, politics, and business news. Whether you're a founder, investor, or operator in a startup, you'll gain insights into how current events connect to broader themes and trends that impact your startup, your investments, and your day-to-day operational decisions. The conversation starts now.
Hi, I'm Yaniv Bernstein.
And I'm Chris Saad.
And I'm Emil Michael.
Welcome to this week's Startup Podcast Reacts. On today's show, we're going to discuss Apple issuing a huge dividend and a giant buyback. Is this representative of their slowing growth and product incrementalism, or is this just good management? We talk about ChatGPT, Perplexity, and Google fighting it out for the next generation search game. Who might win, and is search even relevant in a post-LLM world? And finally, and most provocatively, we talk about a post-election civil war in the US. Could electing Biden lead to massive civil unrest and even dreaded civil war? Stay tuned to learn more about that and much more on this week's show.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. You might know that sinking feeling. You're about to land a big contract when they ask about compliance, SOC 2, ISO, PCI, Essential 8. You've just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. Not anymore. Vanta massively accelerates your compliance efforts and allows you to get those life-changing deals back on track. Don't wait until it's panic stations, though. Get started with Vanta today. They're offering 20% off their prices just for TSP listeners. Do yourself a favor. Hit pause. Go to vanta.com/TSP. That's VANTA.com to get that 20% off. Okay, so the first thing we wanted to talk about today is Apple's big earnings, and even more interestingly, their massive return of capital to shareholders. So Apple earns a lot of money, even amongst the Magnificent Seven. They are and have been a fire hose of cash for a really long time. They've had massive cash reserves. They started returning it to shareholders a while ago through stock buybacks. But this year, they have done two things. First of all, a buyback, and they are returning a dividend for the first time. And the buyback is massive. It is over $100 billion. That's bigger than the market capitalization of most companies. Now, typically, this sort of thing happens when companies feel like, well, we can't make good use of this capital. The best return for our investors is to give it back to them. So Apple, you know, ever since Steve Jobs came back, I guess has been on a growth tear. The conventional wisdom is big tech companies are very frugal with returning capital because they want to keep investing in the future. And the timing is also interesting because right now, there are other bits of earnings as well coming out of Facebook, Google, Microsoft. Everyone is increasing their spend because of one thing, and that one thing is AI. People are buying huge numbers of GPUs, building out huge new data centers, preparing themselves for what they see as a future growth opportunity. And of course, Apple, by the way, still spending a lot of money, but I thought the timing of this was interesting. And what does it say about Apple, how they see themselves, and maybe about the sort of Magnificent Seven and the future of these now gigantic companies, the biggest companies in the world?
I mean, here's what's extraordinary. Apple has done, I read, $450 billion of buybacks already since Tim Cook's joined. Like, holy cow. So they've already returned a ton to shareholders, and they're doing $100 billion more, which is just extraordinary. But I guess that's kind of what you do if, I mean, their balance sheet is still enormous, right? So they've shrunk the number of shares. The counter argument is that they're not investing in R&D in new things. You do buybacks when you're out of ideas, is this sort of criticism from Wall Street on that. But it's also a sign potentially of good management that they're like, if we don't have better ways to spend the money, we're going to give it back to shareholders. So I think that it's fine because when Apple takes out debt, I don't know if you've seen any of their debt deals, they're like rated like the US government. So if they ever needed money, they could like get more of it. So it's probably a smart thing to do.
They're obviously seeing slowing growth. They're obviously facing headwinds in China. And they obviously wanted to keep the stock buoyant and keep the story moving up and to the right. Maybe this is a result of good discipline and good management. I'm starting to get a little bit frustrated by Apple's discipline and incrementalism. Emil, you said they maybe run out of good ideas. You know, there are a lot of amazing categories they could get into. A lot of Apple-like thinking they could contribute to those categories. And I have to believe there's a way to scale their culture, their Apple-like focus, to a few more categories of products. And this might be funny to say in the face of an Apple Vision Pro or their canceled car project, but I think there are a number of just more straightforward products, like the Google Assistant, Google Home, which they keep sort of half doing with AirPods and with HomePods, Nest-style devices. You know, I've been on the show talking about the glasses. There's just a number of things I'd like to see Tim Cook be doing, and they're just being extremely incremental. Extremely. So I just watched the supercut of the iPad announcement this morning, and it's like, what a surprise. The iPad Air has all the features that the iPad Pro had. And now, you know, they've moved down. And now the iPad Pro has all the features we predicted already. It's like, yawn. Do something. Do something. I continue to believe that with a proper AI strategy, hopefully starting to reveal itself at WWDC, that should accelerate their opportunities, their potential for upside on the business, on the stock. I'd just like them to do something a little more interesting outside of Vision Pro.
The thing, Chris, is though, they have enough money to do that and do the buyback, right? You're talking about, like, strategically, you don't feel like they're pushing hard enough.
Yeah, I mean, that is the button I was going to put on, which is, of course, they still have enough capital, enough lending capacity to go do whatever the hell they want, irrespective of how much money they give back. I guess these two subjects are parallel. Interesting they gave the money back. I'd like to see them spend more time thinking about how do they do something innovative and not so incremental, aside from Vision Pro. I think Vision Pro is a very particular kind of bet. I think the car was, to me, a bizarre kind of side bet. But there are very fundamental, traditional categories of technology that deserve the Apple ecosystem touch. And I think that's worth touching for them. And so that's neither here nor there, I guess, with the question of the buyback. They did what they did. The stock is where it is. And we'll see what happens with the AI story.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's a couple of things here. Like, first of all, if you think about it, you know, there's been this sort of cult of growth in shares. And, you know, one of the things that distinguishes a share from a derivative, or effectively simply a speculative bet on the future direction of the share price, is the fact that eventually you've invested in a profitable business and some of those profits end up being returned to the shareholders. And so I feel like, yes, sometimes that time can be a long way in the future, decades in the future, but eventually a successful company should be returning capital to its shareholders, because that is actually the point of it. And, you know, it has been decades. Apple for a long time was not profitable, although, as you say, Emil, you know, they started doing stock buybacks, which are effectively a way of returning capital some time ago. So I think that's reasonable. But to me, there's a symbolism here in the timing where everyone else is accelerating their investments because of AI, and Apple is sort of not. And instead, this is how they're allocating their capital. Yeah, they're not out of ideas. And, you know, I think there is a limit to how much you can spend. But it was interesting. Mark Zuckerberg was on the Dwarkesh podcast, which is a pretty good podcast. And he was talking about what he's learned about AI. So this is really interesting in terms of where Meta is thinking, right? Basically, they were pursuing this metaverse thing, which has obviously so far, you know, been a total flop. But because of the metaverse work they were doing, they'd actually pre-ordered a lot of GPUs. And now AI happened. And Zuckerberg's like, thank God we overinvested in those GPUs. Thank God we ordered more than we thought we needed. And now their forward orders for AI, for GPUs and data center capacity, he's like, they've just taken their estimate and they've doubled it, right? Because he's like, we don't know what's going to happen, but we don't want to be caught flat-footed when the next inflection point comes. So he's still very growth-oriented. And Apple, it's like, well, there's been this weeping sore that is Siri that everyone hates and doesn't seem to be getting any better. Everything they do is kind of moving quite slowly. You know, that word discipline you use, Chris, like the Vision Pro is really cool. It still has time, but also so expensive, right? So Apple aren't willing to, like, take a hit on margins to get more people using these things. So it still feels like a bit of a science project. And I don't know, just adding all these things together, it's like, you mentioned the iPad announcement. Well, I saw that was coming up. I was like, oh, do we put that on the agenda? I'm like, no, this is no longer interesting. It's not a noteworthy announcement, right? Like, when Apple announced stuff a few years ago, that was like one of the biggest tech stories of the year. And now it's, who cares? New iPhones, like, they're the same as the year before. And so I do think they're caught in this spot where everybody else is kind of tooling up for the future. And it's not clear that Apple are taking the same approach.
You have an operational person in charge of the company. And I think he's done a very good job in maintaining product cadence. He's even made a few new interesting product bets. But I don't perceive Tim Cook, and I don't think anybody does, as some kind of product visionary, as some kind of big, bold bet, fast forward to the future guy. He's no Travis. He's no Mark Zuckerberg. He's no Bill Gates. He's no Steve Jobs. And he's at risk of becoming Steve Ballmer. At risk. He has not done that, but he's at risk. And these bets take a long time to play out. And so I feel like the discipline has just ticked that little bit too much. The incrementalism has ticked just that little bit too much. And again, I know some might be listening going, that's pretty funny given the Apple Vision Pro and whatever. There's more to do. There's more to do.
We may all be surprised when they make their AI announcement. Like, yes, Siri's not approving because they're throwing Siri out and they're going to want something else that's sort of Siri-like. And we're going to suffer with that until they launch it August, September. I do think they totally missed the home audio camera, which is a no-brainer.
Right.
Like total no-brainer stuff. Like who wouldn't want cooler Apple devices than these Ring cams or these Nest cams and all these things. They had the home pod, but there was like nothing else there. So I never thought the car was a particularly good idea. But yes, there's some obvious things they missed. And now I do think their China business at serious risk as U.S.-China relations continue to deteriorate. And it's a big thing for them. On the sales side, like manufacturing, they've started to move to other countries and de-risk that. But yeah, I think there's a gap in inventiveness there that I think needs to get filled. And I don't know how it is going to get filled.
Yeah, right. I mean, you nailed it, Emil. Like, how is my house not filled with high-end speakers by Apple or by Beats, high-end security cameras, high-end thermostats, you know, high-end whatever. And I get it. I get it. Apple does a small set of things really well. I get it. But like, how old are these categories? How enmeshed are they in our lives? You know, there's plenty of time to have done the Apple last mover advantage play. And it's just like, oh my God, we're getting AirPod Max USB-C at some point in the near future, hopefully, if we're very, very lucky. Like, give me a break. Come on. So yeah, I'm with you. Okay, for our next topic, we want to talk about rumors that ChatGPT is working on a search product that will rival or could rival Google. Now, of course, we all know Google is the house that Search built, and Search is one of the most important products and services on the internet. It's an intent fulfillment machine. It's often said that if you can fulfill intent quickly on the internet, you make and print billions and billions of dollars, and no one's done it better than Google. That's Google's beating heart. That's where all their revenue comes from. And so for OpenAI and by extension, Microsoft to be building some kind of next generation search product, that would be a direct, let's call it attack or risk or threat for the Google core business, something that Bing has not been able to pull off in days gone by. And so the question becomes, what does this product look like? How might Google respond? And will it make a real dent in Google's business? And might we be moving over from Google search to Bing search or to ChatGPT search or OpenAI search any day soon? It's also worth pointing out there's a startup called Perplexity, which has been building what they think of as an AI-powered search, an alternative, a next-gen search. I've played with a little bit. It hasn't captured my attention yet, but that doesn't mean they're not onto something. But that might be a glimpse at what an OpenAI search might look like, what the future of search might look like. And so what do we think of this, boys? What happens to the future of search? What does it look like? And what does Google do to respond?
I mean, I think that even if OpenAI didn't do anything from an interface standpoint, it's naturally going to take search volume. Like when you open ChatGPT, you're searching, right? And therefore, it's just an alternative, not a perfect substitute, but an alternative way to get information that you might want. If it becomes even more, from a UI standpoint, similar and useful to the way Google is it a threat to like all their business? No, but is it a threat to their market share? Maybe, for sure. If it has better, I mean, the knock on Bing for years has been that the answers are just not as good. And the advertising, people complain about the blue links. We want the blue links. We click on them. A lot of people click on them for a reason because they're relevant. And it hasn't been that case for Bing. And so I do think this notion of a foundation model generally is a threat to Google. And it could be a Perplexity. It could be a Bing. It could be OpenAI. I think all of them are a threat to their dominance.
I mean, look, they're threats. No doubt they're threats. But I actually look at this and I'm long Google. Search is really hard. And nobody has come close to Google on search for a very, very long time. Microsoft put billions of dollars into Bing, tens of billions, I would say, by this point, and they didn't come particularly close. Since ChatGPT was released, and then, you know, there was Bing with ChatGPT and so on, there's been a lot of concern about, oh, everyone's going to Bing it, and then they come back to Google. So search is really hard, and Google has a massive lead. Now, on the other side, AI is really hard. But Google is in the game there. We've talked about that in previous episodes, right? They've been the sleeping giant of AI, but they are a giant just as much as they are in search. And that giant's kind of gotten its wake-up call, I think. And I think adding Google's level of AI to Google search is going to be a much smaller lift than adding a Google level of search to AI. AI does not make search obsolete. We talked briefly, and maybe if we get Ali back on, who's got a bit more of the technical chops, we can talk again about RAG, retrieval augmented generation, which is basically this idea of letting the AI use search to get better answers, right? To reduce hallucinations, to get up-to-date information and so on. Now, that's what Perplexity does. Perplexity is pretty good. But my bet is Google's resources, Google's AI chops, Google's search chops are going to be better than what Perplexity can do in the medium term. There are already, I think, experiments, I think, depending what part of the world you're in and so on, where when you do Google searches, it prioritizes an AI-generated response ahead of the blue links. So I just kind of feel that one of the interesting things about AI so far is that most of the benefits have accrued to the Magnificent Seven. This hasn't been a disruption opportunity yet, and I actually don't see Google being disrupted in search.
I think I mostly agree with you, but here's a few thoughts. Saying search is hard might sound like saying, look, managing horses is really hard in the face of the invention of the automobile. It's kind of like, yeah, managing horses is hard, but no one gives a shit about that in a post-Henry Ford world. And so maybe the problem of search as we know it and the difficulties associated with that are no longer as relevant as they used to be. Maybe. But here's where I'm going to disagree with myself and agree with you, Yaniv. It is easier to add AI to Google search than to add Google search quality to ChatGPT or to Bing. And so I think to the degree that search and search grounding of AI is important, then Google has the advantage. And so Google potentially has the advantage for whatever comes after search, because they have the AI chops, they have the search, and they can do a really good job there. But already I use ChatGPT before Google, or after Google fails me, which is increasingly true, to get answers to most of my questions these days. So this is already happening. And I think the future of search is actually agents. You know, I continue to believe that you're going to have one personal agent who knows who you are, who knows your history, who has the personality you like, has the context you need, and is going to be pervasively following you around. It'll be on your device, on your mobile device, on your headphones, in your laptop, probably in your home devices that Apple still needs to create. And you're just going to speak into the ether, and it's going to go do searches for you. It's going to go do transactions for you. It's going to go do work for you. And you're never going to see a search box again in your life, probably, you know, probably 5% of the time. And so whoever owns that agent owns the distribution and owns whatever search engine is underneath, and will own the monetization, because the monetization will not necessarily be ads. It'll be the transactional clip of the ticket as you go around the world executing transactions.
It's a paradigm shift in terms of how users are going to interact with these foundation models. So like, you don't have to be great at search necessarily in the Google sense. You know, if you wanted the 10 best chiropractors in your area and you type that into both search or Perplexity or OpenAI, it's not clear that Google would necessarily give you a better answer.
Not right now.
Like, why is the case?
Because the point is, like, there are two aspects of this, right? There is the technology and the processing capability on the one side, and there's the data on the other side. And the point is, with these RAGs, the search results are the data. They're the input alongside the model to the result. So if you have the best search capability, then you're going to be feeding the best data into your model, into your RAG, when people ask the question. And I think that's when I'm talking about, you want to be both good at search and good at AI to really be able to solve this use case. The interface might not look like 10 blue links at all, but...
Yeah, I've just defined RAG for the audience again.
Oh, that's the retrieval augmented generation. Retrieval meaning search. So you're having an LLM that is effectively using search to provide better quality and more up-to-date information. That's what Perplexity does.
Right. So the idea is when you ask the LLM something, it goes to a store of knowledge, retrieves it, and it augments its answer based on that knowledge. And when you're asking it a search question, it goes to a search engine, retrieves the search results, and uses those search results to augment its response. And if your search engine that it's using is better than the other search engine, you win, presumably, right? Because if Google's 10 blue links, and by the way, Google's not been 10 blue links for a long time. They have this incredible knowledge graph and incredible summarization and all this other stuff. I think we do them a disservice by calling them just 10 blue links. If Google's search result page or data object is better than Bing's, then Google's AI has an advantage just from that knowledge base that it's retrieving from. And as you said, Yaniv, Google's pretty bloody good at AI as well. So you marry those two things, it's like peanut butter and jelly, and Google has a real advantage here. And OpenAI is working with a disadvantage, which is Microsoft's garbage at Bing. And so we'll see how this plays out. I think it's going to be very exciting to see. But as I said, I think ultimately this is going to be a distribution game, and whoever owns the agent is really going to win.
I have one other thought on this before we move on, actually, which I think is, again, why I'm long Google. Distribution, right? Distribution is always underestimated, which is like, where do people go? What is the muscle memory when people have questions they want to ask, right? And again, Chris, you say you use ChatGPT first. We have to accept that, you know, we are all technology people, technology early adopters. But Google pays Apple, was it $17 billion a year or whatever, to be the default search on iPhones. It is the default search on most Android phones. Chrome is the dominant browser in the world. Guess what the default search is on Chrome? And so I think the point is people have decades of muscle memory. Their devices prioritize Google search. And so I kind of feel Google gets to fumble the bag on this a couple of times and will still come out winning. They need to fuck up royally for a long period, which they're capable of doing. They've done that in messaging for sure, to not come out ahead here, right? Because they have all the advantages.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm alluding to, right? Which is thinking of it as a search war is, I think, the wrong level to be looking at it. I think it's an agent war, and who owns the surfaces by which the agent is invoked, and how pervasive or ubiquitous are the agents. You have Google's assistant and all their surfaces, and you have Apple's assistant and all their surfaces. And you have Microsoft's devices, which have all been switched to Google search. And they'll stick, you know, Cortana or Copilot or some other nonsense there. So you're really back to a three-agent world, and may the best agent win.
This episode of the Startup Podcast is brought to you by Vanta. The team at Vanta are passionate about helping you secure your business by vastly cutting down on the time to get compliant with frameworks like ISO 27001, SOC 2, and Essential 8. Vanta lets you close deals, sleep better at night, and get back to building your product. Help yourself and help the podcast by going to vanta.com/TSP for an exclusive 20% off deal.
All right. Next topic we wanted to discuss, this one is going to be more political than usual, more purely political at least. I had a couple of scenarios I wanted to play out for you guys, and I wanted to see what you thought. I've done this a couple of times now, so we'll see how this one goes. It's actually less political, I think, and more about democracy.
That sounds political.
Well, I mean, there's politics over the top of democracy, and then there's kind of the democratic institutions and the society in which we live, right? And so I'm really talking about governance, and I'm talking about democracy and how current politics may affect those. And so obviously the stability of the US government is super important to startups everywhere, to human beings everywhere. You know, it's District One. We all need a good, happy, healthy US governance model and government. People on that front are mostly focused right now, I think, on the US election. You know, will Biden win? Will Trump win? And I don't see a lot of people talking about what happens post-election. And I think irrespective of who wins, I think there's a meaningful chance, actually, of significant instability and even violence, irrespective of who wins. And I wanted to kind of talk you guys through that and explain my reasoning and then see what you think. Let's talk about the first more obvious case first. So if Biden wins, you can see it playing out like last time where Trump refuses to concede, continues to perpetuate a lie that the election was rigged. Things may come to a head again around, let's say, a January 6th style event, maybe bigger, since maybe January 6th was, let's say, a dress rehearsal, and it could trigger a larger set of political unrest or political violence. Maybe. I think there's a meaningful chance something like a January 6th happens again, and, you know, might that trigger some more back and forth? But I think the more subtle case is if Trump wins, he continues dismantling democratic institutions and norms, right? This is not a theory. He's been doing that all along. Media is the enemy of the people. The courts have been stacked with Trump supporters. Once independent departments have attempted to be weaponized against people, and I think that'll only happen more. And then the question becomes, is there another election? Is there another free and fair election? Is there another uncontested election? I don't know, but somewhere along that timeline, it'll feel like chaos and everyone's upset and protests and whatever, and it'll be like a frog in boiling water. What is going on? We don't know. But at some point, when does that become violent? Because again, he crosses some line for someone somewhere and things are not going the way the majority of the country wants. And so in both cases, I'm seeing like a really meaningful chance that there is a delayed violent reaction after the election, and that it has some degree of chance to cascade. Maybe zero chance, maybe some chance or more.
I want to hear, Emil.
I actually think the bigger risk is if Trump gets elected. I don't know if you remember, after he got elected in 16, 2 million women took to the streets with these hats. And yeah, there was a lot more. It wasn't violence, but it was the people were angry about the result. And I think they'll be even angrier this time. I kind of disagree almost completely that there's some destruction of democratic norms if he wins. Like, if he wins legit like he did in 16, and there's no dispute about it, people will be angry. But like, he could say what he wants about the press. For hundreds of years, the presidents have hated the press. And so he calls them a nastier name than others. I don't think that's a destruction of the press. And by the way, the American people have totally lost trust in the press before Trump. They totally said that institution has destroyed itself. He's appointed people to the court. Biden's appointed more people to the federal courts, not Supreme Court, than Trump has. Biden has forgiven nearly $1 trillion in student loans after the Supreme Court told him he shouldn't be doing it. So he found another way to do it. So I just don't buy it's democracy versus autocracy. That's just not a thing. I think it's just people are going to be angry no matter what. On January 6th, had there been 300 police officers there at the Capitol, it just wouldn't have happened. So like, I'm pretty sure that to the extent Biden wins, like, they'll just be more prepared. There might be a fissure where people are just angry, but I don't think this turns into like a violent conflict in either scenario.
To your point, Chris, you were saying this is not about politics, this is about democracy, but it would appear to me very much that an individual's political leanings pretty much define the extent to which they're worried about whether this is a threat to democracy. And so it's nearly like people can't agree on a basic set of facts or a basic neutral interpretation of those facts. And it's very hard to divorce all of this from Donald Trump, because the way that people interpret him seems wildly different, right? Is he a threat to democracy, or is he someone that just says it like it is and maybe uses, you know, what did you say, Emil, nastier language to say the same things that politicians and presidents have always said?
More provocative language. He's more provocative, which is part of why people like listening to him. But you could argue, like, there's so many arguments, counterarguments. Hillary said when she lost in 16 that Trump only won because of the Russians. Stacey Abrams, when she lost governor, she still hasn't conceded the governor's race in Georgia. Hakeem Jeffries didn't vote for Trump's electors. Like, this just feels like...
Yeah, but this is all a recent phenomenon, right? There has never been a candidate, as far as I understand it, in modern political history in the US, who failed to concede the election, congratulate the winner, and wish for his success or her success, close the campaign and move on. I am not aware of that happening in modern...
That has not been the norm. Correct.
Right. And I've been writing, you have to believe me, Emil, for years, decades, about the loss of faith in the media and their own self-inflicted wounds there. But I don't think there has been such a loss of faith in democratic institutions and norms as there has been under Trump, encouraged by and heightened by Trump. One of the most interesting things I've ever heard someone say about Trump is that liberals seem to take him literally, but not seriously. And conservatives seem to take him seriously, but not literally.
Peter Thiel said that, apparently.
I think in some cases you need to take him literally, and in all cases you need to take him seriously. I'm always confused by people's diminishing of his power to break important mental models and consensus that the US has about its own civilization, its own country. And these are things that are already hanging on by a thread.
Hold on, man. Look. The CDC and the COVID and the inability for those institutions to like go back and say we were wrong about this or wrong about that was ridiculous. And that wasn't Trump. That was like...
But that was Trump.
No. It was after Trump left in 21 when they wouldn't send kids back to school until that fall. They told Facebook, you can't publish this, or we don't prefer you don't publish that. That all like information suppression and therefore the loss in the medical establishment. And even with the trans issues, the sort of lack of confidence, those things happened not because of Biden, but during Biden.
Yeah. So let's not debate kind of the right or wrong of what was said and when it was said. But what I am trying to point out is that without Trump being a very vocal proponent that these things that were being said are wrong and are therefore malicious and are therefore dangerous and therefore anti-democratic and therefore you must believe in and vote for Trump, there was no person who would take a pandemic and point at the pandemic response, which was likely to be as well-meaning as possible and as well-intentioned as possible, however bumbled or fumbled, and say, this is the government trying to take your freedom and you need to like rise up, basically. You're turning it into a political opportunity and a loss of faith in government and governance to a degree that leads to a January 6th. There's a difference between, hey, they fumbled the ball on COVID, maybe. We can argue who did that, why they did that, when that happened, why. But the intensity of the response and backlash to the fumbling of the ball, let's assume that's what happened, was supercharged by Trump and Trumpism.
But here's what I'll disagree with you on the thing, because I think you're getting your timelines messed up. When he called it the China virus, it was like racist, that didn't come from the lab, and all of a sudden turns out it likely came from a Chinese lab. And
yeah, but I'm not really talking about that stuff, Emil. That stuff is mostly benign.
Okay, hold on. So then when the vaccine came out in January of 21, when Biden was inaugurated, the teachers unions stopped kids from going back to school in many states. And the governors who rejected that ended up being right. And a loss of a school year of school was very damaging to these, especially poor kids.
Let's say I agree with you. Let's say for the sake of argument, I agree with you. More damaging is... well, you can't trust the courts, you can't trust the CDC, you can't trust the media, you can't trust what the CIA is telling you, you can't trust anyone or anything except me. Again, let's assume for the sake of argument that the media fumbled the ball or political correctness fumbled the ball on China and where the virus came from. Let's say they fumbled the ball on how to deal with the virus. Let's say they fumbled the ball on kids out of school for a year. The problem is not the fumbling of the ball. The problem is those guys are malicious, incompetent, and dangerous. Those institutions that you believe in, people, and I'm the only one who can give you the truth. And creating a cult of personality around an individual instead of around institutions. I would rather the CDC fumble a year of school for kids than for the American people to lose faith in the CDC. You know what I'm saying? Or rather lose faith in the CIA, because this is the fundamental organs of the government and of the country.
I understand. And again, I do believe this is generally colored by people's opinions on the candidates, me included. But I will say this, like, this is not that relevant for startup founders, but the moment Trump was inaugurated in the office, they started a multi-year investigation on the Russia papers, the dossier where he was in a Russian hotel, which was totally false. And it was spent years with the justice system that was going after him for that. So you could imagine the grievance that he would have, where your first act as president, the romance of the first 100 days, you don't have it because you're doing that. So of course, he's going to say the system's corrupt. There's like five or six court cases now. Most of these are garbage.
Let's assume I take your premise wholesale, which I don't, but let's, for the sake of argument, say I take your premise on all of the court cases. All the court cases are frivolous. The courts themselves are not. And I think part of his defense is you don't get to prosecute a president. You don't get to prosecute me. The courts are illegitimate. And because this judge was elected by or placed by a Biden or by an Obama, that makes them illegitimate. And so any defense that involves an erosion of trust, public trust in the system of justice is, I would say, dangerous and divisive and damaging to of the highest degree and is unbefitting a president. But I'm not actually arguing whether Trump is a good person or a bad person. I'm a bit surprised that you don't think of him as dangerous, actually. I think he's been dangerous and I think that's been like provably true. But that's actually not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about, for whatever confluence of reasons, irrespective of who wins, we are where we are, and I'm seeing a meaningful pathway to civil unrest, irrespective of who wins, and a delayed effect. So I'll tell you why I say delayed, why I emphasize delayed. I was really thinking about moving back to the US, and I was thinking, well, maybe I don't want to be there under Trump. Let's see who wins the election, and then I'll decide. And then I was talking to my friend and I was like, hang on a second. If Trump wins, I believe he will continue to dismantle faith and efficacy of the institutions of democracy. And if Biden wins, I think Trump won't concede. This plays out towards a non-zero chance of violence and a real threat to American democracy long term. And I just feel like I have not heard anybody else talk about it in those terms. They're kind of fixated on who's going to win the election. And I think we need to be looking past the election.
If these college protests are a harbinger of things to come, it's the Trump election that will drive occupations of buildings and all this crazy stuff in another version, not against the Israeli-Gaza war, but against Trump. And I actually think there's much more risk of civil unrest.
I agree with you. That is a pathway to the unrest that I'm speaking of. And I think like the Gaza protests, they may start off peaceful and then the Trump-backed police action against them or the MAGA reaction against them will make them violent. And so it will become from a peaceful protest or let's say angry protest, maybe even violent protest from the left, I'll even give you that, will turn into increasing, escalating violence because of police action. He wanted to shoot the people that were getting in his way because he wanted to walk across the yard. And he was asking, can't we just shoot them in the legs? I mean, like he wanted to nuke a storm. Like he's willing to use violence against like the population. And I'm saying once he's in his last term in office and there are fewer reasonable people around him, yeah, I agree with you. The protests from the left can turn into violence from the left and right. And I'm worried about the response from there. That's just one of many pathways I see to civil unrest post-election.
You guys are living in a bubble. Look at 2016 and 20. Was there a dictatorship in this country when Trump was elected? No,
yeah,
of course
not. Yes.
No, hang on. He lost if both houses Trump's, of Congress.
If you believe Trump's argument in court that the president should have full immunity, okay, he believed himself to be in a dictatorship.
No, that's just not true.
So, and he tried to overturn the election so he could maintain his dictatorship.
No. Any lawyer in America who studies the Supreme Court will know that like they take polarized arguments. So the argument on one side was that he has no immunity, which is also absurd. Meaning some random U.S. attorney in Mississippi could go, Joe Biden, I'm going to fucking indict you for taking bribes from the Ukraine. Like, that's not okay. No. So you can't, there has to be some presidential immunity where they're not dragged into court in any biased prosecution sense. And on the other hand, of course, there's no full immunity. You can't just like murder people, political rivals. So the intellectual argument was made and the Supreme Court sent it back, is probably going to send it back and said, you have to define some principles about when the president's immune or not, because it's definitely not zero and it's definitely not all. But that was just a way to make the argument in front of the Supreme Court. I just think, again, the media is making too much of that argument.
Yeah, I continue to believe the problem is one of conflation. And in the latest example here is the conflation between Trump's policies and Trump the man. Like, again, I could, once again, for the second or third time in this episode, I could give you the entire argument that every one of Trump's policies are better than the Democratic ones, just for the sake of argument. I'll give you that. I think the border does need to be more controlled, not in the way he describes it, but it needs to be more controlled. I think China does run roughshod over the US in some ways, but maybe the way he responded, the way he talked is ineloquent and belligerent. On and on and on. I actually think, you know, we've had an Israel debate, Palestine debate on this show. I actually think the Abraham Accords were helpful to Palestine because it makes the situation clear and codifies the reality on the ground. And so stop wishing for things that are never going to happen. I'll give you all of that, but he is not just an imperfect person to espouse and execute those ideas, he is a dangerous person to espouse and execute those ideas. And you get the baby and the bathwater. Nobody votes in a dictator. They vote in the good parts and they get the bad parts as well. And you're not taking him literally or seriously in the ways that I am, Emil. And it's clear 30, 40% of the country is not in the US. And I think they do that at extreme peril. Extreme peril. And I don't know why they're even flirting with the peril versus one of his other lackeys to vote.
But there you go. You're like, these people must not be taking him seriously. Therefore, they're not smart enough to understand the consequences.
I think they have too much faith in the American system and don't understand how fragile it's become. I think part of them are happy for a dictatorship along the lines in which they believe. And I've seen them. Especially the crazy right-wing extremists, Christians especially, they are happy for the truth-loving, Bible-thumping America to be controlled by... They believe Trump was provided to them by Jesus. Okay, and that the Constitution was divinely inspired.
Yes, but then the extreme left wants to defund the police.
Because the extreme left are, in many cases, in many ways, fucking morons as well. And choose very poor slogans, but the extreme left are not at risk of electing a wannabe strongman. So they don't matter, right? Anyway, I didn't want this to turn into a debate about Trump, although it is fun. I love having this. And Emil, I want to have more of these debates with you, my friend.
I'm calling this. I'm calling this.
Yeah, let's go.
This is too much. This is too much the weeds.
Let's wrap it up. But I do think, I haven't heard any of us say a kind of contradictory theory here. I do think Is it fair to say, to summarize, all of us believe there is a non-zero, even a non-minor chance that there will be meaningful political violence in the US post-election. And that creates a destabilizing force for the startup ecosystem, for the business ecosystem, and the global political system in general. Is it fair to say we all agree on that?
I would say I feel there's a higher probability of it than there has ever been in my lifetime in US elections, presidential elections, yes.
I agree with that. I don't think it's probable. It's more possible than it's been before.
Well, yep. There you have it, guys. You heard it here first. Prepare for the improbable or ignore this entirely.
All right, guys.
All right, guys. And this is a more spicy one than usual. I love these. We want to do more spicy stuff. But Emil, how can people find you on the internet if they want to follow more of your work and send you a big resounding, I agree with you, and Chris is crazy?
I could be fine at Emil Michael on X, formerly known as Twitter.
And Yanev?
I'm most active on LinkedIn. You can also find me at YBernstein on the product soon to be known as Twitter once again.
And you can find me on all the social media, Chris Saad. And you can also find me at chrissaad.com and chrissaad.com/newsletter where I control my own damn distribution. Anyway, all right, guys, as always, we'll catch you in the next one.
Okay, see ya. This episode of the Startup Podcast was brought to you by Vanta. Vanta helps businesses get and stay compliant by automating up to 90% of the work for the most in-demand compliance frameworks. With over 200 integrations, you can easily monitor and secure the tools your business relies on. Head to vanta.com/TSP for 20% off their incredible offering and start unlocking extra revenue today.
What are we drinking?
I think it's not a well-known fact that Emil is usually sporting a glass of wine during the recordings. So what is it today, Emil?
It's a California Cabernet. It's 6 o'clock here on the East Coast. It's 1 o'clock. I like it dry and bold.
That's kind of like you, right? Dry and bold. That explains why Emil's takes are spicier and more interesting than ours typically.
As the session goes on. All right.